Les colloques du Collège de France.
If everyone has a handout, then without further ado, I would like to introduce Enrico Terrone, who is an associate professor of aesthetics at the University of Genoa, and he's going to talk about the two borders of fiction, belief and entertaining.
Okay.
Thanks, Meryl, and thanks, François, for inviting me. I'm glad to be here. So just let me put my chronometer on. So are we? Yes, we have 5 minutes early. Can I start nevertheless? Or do you prefer me to wait?
Tell a few jokes for
Okay, I will introduce slowly. So the most interesting things are coming after 5 minutes. Okay, so I'm indeed, as the title say, I'm interpreting the title of the workshop, The Limits of Fiction, by interpreting limits as borders. So I want to explore what's the two areas that surround the realm of fiction. So usually there is just one border, at least the popular border is the fiction non-fiction divide. So the usual assumption is that there is one border that is interesting when it comes to fiction, and it's the border that separates fiction from non-fiction. What I want to argue in this talk is that there is another border that is worth considering, and is the border that separates fiction from something else, which is not nonfiction, and it's difficult even to give a name to that, because it seems that it's a sort of overlooked area of cultural production, and so I will call it disfiction, just to give it a label. But it's overlooked as a general concept, but I think there are very interesting objects in that area that is worth comparing with works of fiction. So that's the general plan. To do that, I will first introduce a sort of framework in which I think it's worth discussing things about fiction and its borders. And so, and especially the notion of artifact and representation. That's the first two sections of the handout. And then in the third section, I will just say something on the border on which almost everybody agreed, the fiction non-fiction border, whereas the core of the argument is in page 2 of the handout, in which I will try to argue that there is also this other border that is as important as the other one. And then the last section are sort of attempts to face objection and consider further issues that, if I will time, I will also say something on section 5, otherwise this may be reconsidered in the Q&A. So artifacts. I think it's fictions are artifacts. Well, there are three categories that are interesting. The higher level category is that of artifact. Then within artifact, I consider the category of representation, and then I treat fiction as representation. So, philosophy of artifacts is a very active and rising field in contemporary philosophy. I just take some key ideas. So artifacts are objects that have three basic dimensions: creation, structure, and function. So they are created entities, and they are created to perform a function, and then perform the function in virtue of a structure. Structure, I mean, some connection of elements. And so creation is a sort of configuration of the structure, but this creation is made with the aim of having this structure fulfilling a function, where function, by function, I mean a sort of characteristic behavior. So artifacts are made by maker for users, so they have also a sort of almost communicative structure, just like in communication we have a speaker and an audience. In artifacts we have makers and users, and artifacts in a sense mediate between makers and users. The debate on artifacts is often a debate on function. What was the best way of characterizing function? For the purposes of creating representational artifacts, the account of function that I favor is a normative account. So I conceive of the function as a norm that governs the use of the artifacts. So basically the function is not whatever thing an artifact can do, but is what is meant to do, what we expect it to do. So for instance, the function of a pen is writing, even though I can do many other things with a pen. Sure, the function depend on, usually as a dependence on the intentions of the maker. So the function of the pen is writing because the person who created the pen had in mind, had the intention that people use it for writing. But it may be that sometimes social norms can override intentions. So certain artifacts can change their function just because they are used in a community in a way that is not exactly the same as what was originally intended. So, within the vast realm of artifacts, there are some artifacts that fulfill a function that is not practical, that has not to do with matter and energy and movement, but rather with thoughts. And these are what I call representational artifacts, or representation for short. So in this case, by representations, I mean artifacts. So not mental representation, but public representation, representation created by human beings. What's the function of a representation? Well, there is a long tradition about that. It's standing for, that's the expression from Hogeland, but it's an expression that can be found also in classics of the history of philosophy, or in Gombrich essay, seminal essay, representation are artifacts that substitute absent or unreal entities. So it's a function of standing in for or substitution. So it's an object that is in front of us, but so replace something that is not necessarily in front of us. But to specify what this substitution function of representational artifact is, is worth considering how artifacts do something on the mind of the user, how artifacts act upon the mental states on the user. So that's a tradition that comes from the philosophy of depiction, especially in the work by Gombrich himself and Richard Wollheim, and also in the philosophy of fiction. So the idea that artifacts substitute something by eliciting mental states in the user of these representational artifacts. And these mental states are twofold in a broader sense than the one originally intended by Wollheim, in the sense that they always put the user of the representation in a sense in confronted with two objects. The one object that is there to be perceived, and that's the representational vehicle, and then what is represented, and that's an object toward which the mental state can be of, or not only can have a different content, but can also have a different attitude. So some artifacts may elicit a sort of perceptual state, like picture. Other artifacts can have the function of eliciting an imaginative state, and that's the idea of fiction. So that's where fiction enters the picture. So representation in general are artifacts that are meant to elicit mental state, not only about the artifact itself, but also about another object. When the function of the artifacts is to elicit an imaginative mental state about what is represented, the representation is a fiction. So that's a Waltonian approach to fiction. and that's section 3 of the handout, fictional representations that mandate us to imagine what is represented. Example, Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany. The proper engagement with this novel is not to believe what is written in the novel. That would be a sort of misunderstanding. To properly use this artifact, to properly engage with this work of fiction, one should form imaginings starting from the text. On the other hand, non-fictions can be characterized as a representation that mandate us to believe what is represented. So if we take another novel by Capote, In Cold Blood, that's the proper engagement with that is not praising the author for his having invented those characters, for having invented the events. The proper appreciation of this work is to form beliefs, or at least to recognize that the work asks us to form beliefs and to appreciate the writer for creating a representation that has this dysfunction. So that's a sort of consensus view, even though there may be disagreement about whether this distinction between fiction and nonfiction is a sort of track, a sort of natural kinds or essential condition, or is just a sort of matter of standard features. But it seems that it's despite this disagreement, there is a wide consensus that this is a very effective way of tracing the border between fiction and nonfiction. And it's also somehow assumed that this border is the only one. So all the representation can be organized, distributed either on the fiction side or on the nonfiction side of the divide. And that's where my argument show up, and that's section 4, page 2 of the handout. It seems intuitive that Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's is a work of fiction and In Cold Blood is a work of nonfiction. But there are other works of art that are clearly representations. They fulfill the representational function, they stand in for something else, they have the function of directing our minds toward something that is not just the object in front of us. But these objects seems to resist the classification in these two categories, fiction and nonfiction. So, first example, Emily Dickinson poems, A Bird. I don't want to read it because I will spoil it with my bad English, but you can just read it on your own while I drink a glass of water. It's not the whole poem, it's just the first two strophes. And then the second work of art that is clearly a representation is Paul Cézanne's painting Still Life with Peaches and Pears. So how can we locate these two in the fiction-nonfiction divide? Are those fiction or nonfiction? Are we meant to believe that where pears and peaches so disposed in Cézanne kitchen, or we are just meant to imagine that there are pears and peaches on a table in some fictional world. It seems that in this case, the question is just beside the point. It's not crucial to proper appreciation as it was crucial to form beliefs in response in Cold Blood, and form imaginings in response to Breakfast at Tiffany's. So these are representation. We are meant to direct our mind not only towards the surface, but also towards the table and the pears and the peaches. Or we are not meant just to direct our minds towards ink on a paper, but also toward the bird and the other animals that are described in the poem. But it seems that we are not mandated to decide whether all this is happening in our world or in another world that is not ours. It seems that we are just meant to consider these states of affair and enjoy them and appreciate them, but without this need to locate them in one world, as we do when we engage with fiction on the one end or non-fiction on the other end. And so it seems that the mental state, if we characterize the representation as I proposed, as artifacts that have the function of eliciting mental state, that have a certain content, but also a certain attitude, it seems that the attitude that is mandated by the work of art, like this poem or this painting, is not the attitude of believing, but is not the attitude of imagining either, at least not the kind of imagining that is mandated by work of fiction. I propose it's another attitude which is also discussed in philosophy of mind and which is usually called entertaining. I acknowledge that it is controversial whether entertaining and imagining are two distinct mental states. Indeed, most philosophers maybe think that they are just one mental state, they are just two names for the same mental state. But it seems that in this case, seems to suggest that at least there are two interesting mental reactions in response to representational works of art that are worth distinguishing. So for the moment, I will go back to that later, and I'm pretty sure that we will go back to that in the Q&A. But for the moment, I want to use the term entertaining to designate the kind of response that is invited by those works, and that seems different from the kind of response that is invited by paradigmatic fictions or by paradigmatic non-fictions. And since these works invite a mental state that is not imagining in the fiction sense and is not belief either, I propose to use a new term to designate them, and the term I propose to use is disfiction. Also because it seems to me that that's another point that I will make later, but I can anticipate it, that this sort of reaction has some interesting connection with the Kantian notion of disinterest. So that's why at the end I decided to use the term disfiction to designate these under considered objects. So another way of characterizing these objects is by relying on Walter's notion of silly questions. So silly questions, according to Walton, are awkward side effects of an unrestricted appreciation of the prescriptions to imagine that constitutes the engagement with fiction. Walton's example is when one wonders why the rude Othello is speaking in verse. So the idea is, I have to imagine that he's speaking in this way, and this seems weird because it doesn't seem the kind of person that has the education to speak in this way. So this question that can arise if one just say, okay, fiction is prescription to imagine, I have to imagine everything. And the kind of, if one's wonder whether these peers and peaches are really in Cézanne's kitchen or are just in a fictional world. This also seems a sense silly question. So questions that we raise, but that are, according to Walton, are not the kind of question that are part of a proper engagement with fiction. They are silly because they are beside the point. They are not relevant. And this sort of question are can be called silly meta questions. Questions about the status, not about content as in the Otello example, but about the status of the representation itself. And to it seems that if we treat work like Dickinson poem or Cézanne painting by sticking to the traditional fiction non-fiction divide, we are forced to ask this silly meta question. So we are forced to wonder whether this happens in Cézanne kitchen or in a fictional world. Whereas if we have at our disposal this third category of this fiction, and so we respond to this work just by entertaining the content without deciding whether the relevant world is the actual world or the fictional world, then silly meta questions do not arise anymore. And this seems an advantage of the account. So, The final proposal, it's at the end of section four, is to say that the realm of representational artifacts is to be divided not just in two, as is usually done, fiction and non-fiction, but in three regions. So in this sense, there are two borders of fiction. One border that divide fiction as an invitation to imagining, as opposed to non-fiction as an invitation to believe. But there is also this other border that has been overlooked, but is interesting as well, which is the border that divide fiction as an invitation to imagine, as opposed to this fiction as an invitation to simply entertain what is represented. In other words, one may say that a proper engagement with non-fiction requires something like savoring absence. So non-fiction put us in contact with subjects, events that are part of our world, but are not in front of us as the things we can perceive, we can live with. And so it's a way of being in touch with absent entities. On the other hand, fiction as an invitation to imagine, it's a matter of savoring unreality. So we are fiction as the function of as a representational artifact to direct our minds towards entities that are not in our environment, that are not in front of us. But there is more in that. These entities are also meant not to belong to our spatiotemporal system, to our world. So there is no way, even if we have a time travel machine or we can go wherever in the world, we'll never meet Sherlock Holmes. And so in this sense, the engagement with fiction, it has as a sort of aesthetic upshot, savoring unreality. On the other hand, these fictions, like the Dickinson poem or Cézanne painting, give us a different kind of engagement with their content. It's not a matter of savoring absence or unreality, but rather savoring mere possibility. So we consider something just in the way it appears, but we really don't care whether this is occurring in our world or in another world. We are just interested in the way in which things appear to us through the representation. That's the main proposal. I just want to say that it seems to me that this kind of artifacts that I call these fictions are somehow also underexplored in contemporary aesthetic, especially poems. There is a lot on novel themes, on traditional works of fiction. There are also interesting works going on non-fiction. But this maybe this is very speculative. But one possible explanation why these objects that are clearly very interesting, important for the history of literature, for human culture in general, are somehow overlooked or underexplored in contemporary aesthetics. One reason may be that they don't fit properly the fiction non-fiction divide that is a sort of dogma of contemporary aesthetics, but that's just a sort of speculation. Why I'm always surprised why there is so little philosophy of poetry, and so that's a possible explanation, but it's a sort of side thought. What is much more important for this talk is a possible objection to what I proposed. So to this idea that there is not just one distinction between fiction and non-fiction, but there is another important distinction between fiction and disfiction. And that's the above-mentioned idea that entertaining and imagining are just one mental state. So one may object that it doesn't make sense to introduce a third category of representations that have the function of eliciting entertaining instead of imagining, because entertaining and imagining are just the same mental state, and so eliciting entertaining is just eliciting imagining. So these fiction are just fiction in disguise. And if that's my attempt to reply to this objection. So if the objection is just it's a sort of metaphysical level, is the idea that if we want to really carve nature at its joint, carve the mind at its joint, there is just one joint, which is the joint between representation of thing as real, as belonging to our world, as opposed to mental representation of things as not real, as not as not necessary in our world. So, well, maybe the best way to put it is we represent things always with a sort of implicit world parameter, and so there are two alternatives. If the parameter is the actual world, then we have believing. If the parameter is not filled with the value actual world, then we have this other state, which is entertaining, imagining, or simulating, as you prefer. So, if the problem is just metaphysical, I may reply, I don't care. I'm drawing a distinction that has a sort of phenomenological and aesthetic relevance. So, I want to say that there is a difference is what it's like to respond to a novel like Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany, as opposed to responding to a poem like Dickens' On a Bird. So we have, as I said, in one case we savor a world different from ours, in the other case we just savor a mere possibility. So even if at a deep metaphysical level entertaining and imagining are just one mental state, there is still room for distinguishing them, depending. So if what makes them one mental state is the fact that the world parameter is not doesn't have the value the actual world, that's okay. So if this is enough to have one mental state, I'm happy with that. But there remains a difference in whether the world parameter has the value fictional world, and that's the fiction case, or if the word parameter is just unfilled, is just it remains without any value. So we just don't care about that. So in one case, one has engaging with the representation also involve awareness that's not happening in the actual world, whereas in the disfiction case, engagement to representation just involve indifference to whether this happens in the actual world or not. So then a very important notion that a philosopher like Lewis and Walton have highlighted is the notion of truth in fiction. So imagination in response to works of fiction is also aimed to track truth. It's just that it's tracking truth in the fictional world. And so it makes sense to speak of truth in fiction when one imagines in response to fiction. Whereas this notion of truth in fiction doesn't seem to be relevant when it comes to what I call these fictions. So there is another way of stressing the distinction, and it's Brentano's idea that our language is not ideal. So usually we have a sort of prejudice in favor of assertion and belief. So when we say it is raining, we are asserting that it is raining, and we have a modifier to deny that. So it is not raining. But in an ideal language, according to Brentano, we should use "it is raining" just to represent the possibility. So, to elicit a state of entertaining in the audience. And so, as we use "not" to negate the to deny the state of affair, we should use another modifier, something like "yes," to turn the mere possibility into an assertion. But again, if we have in fiction, if you use this ideal language writing a work of fiction, then we should use another modifier, say "yes, the star," to stress that it is raining in the fictional world. So again, this shows that imagining your response to fiction is not mere entertaining, it's something that requires a stronger commitment, and it's this idea of tracking truth in the work of fiction. Whereas this idea of just contemplating the state of a face that is represented without any commitment to truth is what characterizes these fictions. And two last very short points, just to strengthen this idea. Even philosophers like Uriah Kriegel, who defend a view of the mind in which entertaining and imaging are just one mental state, nevertheless, in certain passages of the, this is his book, The Variety of Consciousness, in which he tried to give a sort of general taxonomy of mental state, and in this taxonomy, imagination and entertaining are just one state. But he acknowledged that there is some level at which the two states can be differentiated. And also he writes, "it seems introspectively inaccurate to say that phantasmagoric experiences are attitudinally committed to the unreality of their object. Instead, they seem attitudinally silent on their object ontological status." So that's, he just used a different name, and he just write this in few lines without elaborating on that. But this seems the core idea that motivate this distinction between fiction and disfiction. So in fiction require us to be attitudinally committed to the unreality of their object, whereas disfiction are rather attitudinally silent on their object ontological status. So it's not that we are meant to treat the represented object as unreal, we are just meant to don't care about whether they are real or not. To conclude, this has an interesting connection with Kant's notion of this interest in the third critique, and I quote the passage, "we wish only to know if this mere representation of the object is accompanied in me with satisfaction, however indifferent I may be as regard the existence of the object of this representation." So that's the point. Entertaining is not interest in what is not real, it's just indifference to existence. And upshot of this, the final upshot of this, is that entertaining and this fiction may suggest that this interest, which is in the aesthetic tradition, is often considered the hallmark of every aesthetic experience, maybe can be better characterized as just the hallmark of a very interesting but not total all-encompassing kind of aesthetic experience. So this interest is not the response to every aesthetic, the hallmark of every aesthetic experience, so it's not present in response to every work of art, but only to certain works of art, and these are the works of art that I propose to call this fiction. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.